And now a look at gerrymandering. The Supreme Court has ruled on this practice of cutting up voting districts to benefit one party over another. They decided it's illegal to gerrymander based on race to disenfranchise people of color. Then there was that recent controversial split decision in which the court let partisan gerrymandering stand. That's cutting up a district based on party affiliation. But there's another kind of gerrymandering. Prison gerrymandering. According to those fighting it, it's another way to distort political decisions. Here to explain how it works and why it matters, Alex Kaistera, legal director at the Prison Policy Initiative in Western Massachusetts. So, Alex, what is prison gerrymandering?
Prison gerrymandering is what happens when the Census Bureau counts incarcerated people as if they were residents of the location of the prison where they happen to be on census day, rather than at home. So when that data is used for redistricting, areas that have high prison populations in them get districts that are drawn that don't have enough actual constituents in them, and areas where a lot of prisoners come from end up getting districts that don't account for their entire population.
Right. The areas where the prisons are, which are usually white and rural areas, have inflated population counts and therefore inflated power in all the different ways that you get power from when the district is cut up, whereas the cities and communities where the prisoners might have lived, and sometimes these are inner city African-American communities, they don't have the appropriate count and they don't have the benefit that goes with that. And the other element of this is that prisoners may be counted in prisons in certain districts, but most of them don't vote.
That's right. Most of them don't vote. But in a couple of states like Vermont and Maine, they can vote even while in prison. And in jails, anybody who hasn't been convicted of a felony can, of course, vote across the U.S.
Yeah.
And those folks are actually required to vote back from their home district. So they're not considered residents of the location of the prison.
Yeah. Well,
so they have their own representatives that they're voting for while they're being counted as a constituent of somebody else at redistricting time.
What's some of the fallout from this?
This has a really cumulative effect. Legislators in states where prisons are clumped together end up forming unintentional coalitions against criminal justice reform. Like in New York, for example, the upstate legislators really had no reason to come together against criminal justice reform other than that they viewed the prisons as their way to remain elected. So they were for a long time stopping Rockefeller drug law reform in New York that was supported by a majority of the state. And right now in Rhode Island, the Speaker of the House has a large prison in his district, is against ending prison gerrymandering, and is stopping a lot of criminal justice reform bills from moving through the House.
Because, again, it gives power to these communities that they seem to have inflated populations and everything that comes with that. But some states are addressing this.
Maryland and New York actually redistricted with adjusting their redistricting data to count everybody back at home last decade. And California, Delaware, Washington State, and Nevada are poised to do so for the 2020 census.
Well, what do you say, though, to people who are worried that they will lose funding when this happens, when they can't count prisoners as residents and, you know, have, again, inflated populations?
I can understand where the funding concerns are coming from, because the Census Bureau, you know, advertises that you have to be counted to get all these billions of dollars of federal funds that are distributed on the basis of census data. But what happens is legislators often mistake that to be direct funding. So the funding that's distributed isn't per head type of funding. It all goes through very complicated funding formulas that then trickle down to the cities and counties. And furthermore, the legislation that these states are passing to count everybody back at home only applies to redistricting data. So what happens is the Census Bureau publishes its data and everybody then adjusts that data for their own purposes. It goes through various formulas for funding. It goes through other formulas for redistricting. And this kind of an adjustment to redistricting data would never be used in a funding formula.
Yeah. Well, as you say, some states have already addressed this, but we've got a new census coming, and some states say they can't. You know, there's just not enough time to make any changes necessary, for instance, counting inmates as living in, you know, their home address and not in the prison, you say what?
There's still plenty of time left. The departments of correction are already collecting home address data. And this decade, the Census Bureau is actually publishing its own counts of incarcerated people so that a state can match up the Census Bureau's count with its own Department of Corrections data and make the adjustment. And that data from the Census Bureau for the very first time this decade is going to be coming with each state's redistricting data. So those states with really tight redistricting deadlines will get the data they need from the Census Bureau side early enough to make the adjustment as long as they're ready with their Department of Corrections data.
That's Alex Kaistura, Legal Director of the Prison Policy Initiative in Western Massachusetts, talking about what people are calling prison gerrymandering, inflating and deflating voting areas based on prison populations. Alex, a new phrase for many. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And by the way, Alex says prison gerrymandering doesn't just affect congressional districts. It can affect voting districts at the state and city level as well. We'll link you to more at herenow.org.